Okay, so questions. Oh, yes.
I was just reading in the brochure how it was saying that you did, like, so-called development in North Africa and East Africa. And I was wondering, like, how those experiences that you had contributed to your views that you have now, and whether or not you thought, because sometimes I was an international development major in school, and sometimes I sort of, like, wrestle with the fact that, like, you know, the U.S. historically has done so much harm around the world that, like, sometimes I feel, like, responsible, like, we should help, like, undo some of this harm that we've inflicted, like, you know, not go into societies that are, like, you know, relatively unaffected, but societies that really are, like, you know, completely dominated by the U.S. and, like, help them out, and, like, how does that work with, like, your views on development?
That's something that's interesting that the Russian theoreticians I mentioned today speak about, and that's the moral and the ethical position of a human being becomes pretty solidified in, well, it becomes sort of constructed by the age, Arshavsky believes by the age of 3, the Nikitin family who interviewed Arshavsky believed that by the age of 5, you pretty much, your position, your ethical position, or philosophical position becomes set. And after that, you know, there's a French sociologist, he calls our affective baggage mechanism, our intellectual mechanism, as the habitus that inhabits our flesh. Like, it becomes, his name is Pierre Bourdieu, he's like, he doesn't speak about how the process of acquisition of this habitus takes place. He says that basically all the generations that came before the child transmit this baggage. It becomes sort of your body, your flesh. It's really difficult to undo. You can become aware of it, but habitus always kicks in. And so if by the age of 5, we had, like, great debates with John about this, that my position is that pretty much the human being builds on that philosophical and ethical position, and sees the world and interprets experiences, makes quick decisions, what Bourdieu calls the economy of effort, because you can't every time rationalize about everything. So people just automatically reproduce, institutions produce, moral positions, ethical positions, called traditions, called whatever, contradictions, you know, the whole lot. I don't know if John changed his idea. He thinks people change. You can chip in later. But my own experience shows that basically, pretty much having spent my first 5 years in Russia, Soviet Russia, my grandfather, it turns out, I found out recently, they say he was an anarchist. And somehow, without ever vocalizing or verbalizing his ideas, he transmitted to me this position, like the anarchist position. And the anarchist position, they always, like, okay, what? We would go in the forest, and there's a wounded swan, and it's like, well, you know, what does it feel? You know, how does it live? So that kind of set my you know, constantly, you know, whenever I would be facing a situation, I would be thinking, well, how would that creature, how would that person feel? And it didn't matter whether it was an animal or a person. So when I went into development, international development, and I worked for 1 year as a journalist of war, I was reporting on, I was interviewing all the rebels, all the generals in Northwest Africa were leading, waging wars against each other. Pretty much my ethical position was formed. Obviously, the experiences themselves opened my eyes to a lot that I wouldn't have known. And so, yes, in a way, part of my position is defined by these experiences. And particularly in case of development, it's very strong that the so-called development projects are always, they come from a political structure and they come for a political purpose. And it's, yesterday Wari mentioned it, John talks about, like, you know, most people, you know, in the workshops and, you know, that I, when we talk about these things, it's like, how can you make good out of that which is intrinsically the culprit of all the suffering? How can you ease suffering with suffering? So, Owari's point, if you will, as white Americans, you will always be in a position, like you have this inherent privilege that wherever you will go, you come with that baggage of oppression. How can you undo oppression with oppression? Like, this is a dilemma that is at the heart of it. And it becomes that even with people, like I mentioned earlier, with the best of intentions, they still end up parasiting in that suffering. You know, it's like, I can, you know, give you the examples. I didn't work for that project, but there was, actually there were two, a guy and his girlfriend. A whole UNICEF project. I had, like, the guy and his girlfriend from Boston. And the whole project consisted of teaching displaced Africans how to farm. They had like a huge villa, they had servants, they had cars, and they were given, and it was a UNICEF, United Nations, you know, gets all these donations for people, good-willing people who think, oh, you know, we're doing good, we're easing our guilt, and we're participating, you know, we're giving our money. But the money was going to feed these two individuals. The project they had was giving sterile seeds to refugees, to the displaced refugees in the desert, whose problem was not that they did not know how to farm or how to live with their environment. The problem was that they were displaced and in the desert. They were dispossessed because before they were someone's resource. Now there's no use for them. Now they can die in the desert. And these guys get their, like, with that project money, these people went back to Boston and opened a business. Whilst those people, some of them died before our eyes. And these Boston people who've never planted a seed in their lives would distribute 10 seeds per person and showed, like, this was like the most ridiculous, I mean, it's a play, it's a tragic comedy. That they were showing them how to plant these seeds that would grow only one season. And even if those people did salvage some of the seeds that could reproduce from their, like, that's it. After a while, you get these 10 seeds for free. The next ones you're buying from Walmart. So is that development? Or is that annihilation? You know, so it's like, this is one example, and other examples could be much less, like, you know, literacy programs. Oh, you know, if kids could only read, well, what? If Indian kids in the ghetto could only learn how to read, what? They will get, what, like, become presidents of the United States? They're not even going to become servers in a McDonald's, or whatever other thing they could do, they don't need reading. And their problem is not the literacy. Their problem is the abuse of all the resources, the unequal, the completely brutal exchange rate, the dominant exchange rate that always goes in favor of people going from here, developing them. With these exchange rates, with these currencies. And why are these exchange rates the way they are, it's because of the armies. Because if you don't do what we do, what we like you to do, you'll be bombed and you'll have no exchange rate. So that in the end, some of the Iraqis brought the American troops because it was just unbearable. So you see, it's like the politics that get involved, even with the best intentions, are still, you know, part of this problem. And how can you solve the problem with the problem? Like, how can you save the amputated leg? Okay. You wanted to add something? No? Who else? Questions?
Earlier in your session, you talked a lot about when it comes to raising children, how to keep them becoming domesticated and to you know, help them grow in empathy for other things and other humans and animals alike. But I was just wondering if you're in a situation working with a group of children and they are already at the stage where they have been raised to be domesticated and they're already desensitized through TV and video games, what's the most effective way to, you know, provoke that empathy? As I know that you definitely said, you know, show them through your actions, but, you know, if you have a limited time...
But, you know, it's like asking, for example, the Queen of England coming to Africa after all that, you know, colonization and imperialism. And she does go to Africa every now and then and waves her white glove and tells them, look at me. Okay, you know, a teacher ultimately is like that. Like, you're in the position of the oppressor. No matter how, like, oh, you sweet little thing, I'll show you. Like, and maybe again, with the best of intentions, you might do that. But your position is still in that structure. So, and that structure is that you are not the mother of these children. How will they ever, you're paid to teach them empathy? Like, that's already a contradiction of terms. Like, how can you? Maybe you're the best, most empathic, most compassionate person on earth. I don't know. It could be. But it's all wasted on the fact that you agree to make a living out of the suffering of these children. The parents abandon willfully or being coerced into it, knowingly or unknowingly, they abandon their children in your hands. Like, that's a tragedy. How are you going to deal with it? How, like, yes, you can commiserate, you can show compassion, but I don't see, like, I don't see how it can be a healing or curing situation. I've talked with adopted, like, grown-up adopted children. Actually, it was a side effect kind of project. I was planning for my master's to do research in anthropology on sadomasochism, because what I've seen before in domestication is that fetishism and, you know, these slave dominant relations are so structured in the civilized, at the time I didn't call it the civilized context, but I mean that's what I saw. Like, I go to these, come out of Soviet Union and Africa, and I go to this wonderful West, and what do I see? It's even worse, like, it's even more brutal. And I wanted to do a research project on how does it get played in it, and how come at a certain point, those who accept, like the sadomasochists are the ones who openly say, okay, we love it. Because civilization tells you, okay, you're supposed to suffer, but you're not supposed to enjoy it. Like, you're not supposed to enjoy anything. You're not so supposed to enjoy life, you're not so supposed to enjoy suffering. And at a certain point, it becomes too much. People suffer and they say, hey, we love it. Getting a kick out of it. I didn't finish the, it was too difficult of a topic. I didn't finish it. I changed to Russian rock music and punk rock. So, because I couldn't handle it. But still, you know, what the part that I've done in that research, you know, really marked me very deeply. And one aspect of it, the place where I would go and, you know, for follow-up interviews, they had a whole group, like a whole room that was reserved for the gathering of adopted children who grew up in adoption. And it was like an incredible experience that these, how much tragedy was there. The parents, the adoptive parents who thought were doing something, and, you know, opening their homes and thinking that they were doing it for the best of intentions, taking a child because the child would have died in India or in South Africa from AIDS, or in, you know, murdered or aborted in Brazil. So they're thinking they're doing the best for these children. And when these children, having grown up, have articulated the suffering that they have grown up with, which is that their parents were dehumanized to that point to have abandoned them. It's like it's something that never healed. And they just want, like, what they wanted to relive every time they went to that club I couldn't deal with that. It was horrible. That's an extreme. But you see, like, as a teacher, as an adoptive parent, as a charity worker, as a development worker, you're participating and kind of feeding and making a living of that pain. Now, I have no solution. Like, I cannot, yeah, if you're a good person, if you leave, probably these kids' lives will be even worse. But there's this other aspect. I mean, and I don't know, it's up to you to figure out how you're going to deal with it. I personally wouldn't be even able to go into that, like, and becoming a teacher. And, you know, like, I wouldn't be. So I don't know. With all the information you have, you know, maybe you can figure out something.
So, Leila, what if, like, the children,
why are they abandoning them?
Well, it's because they have to.
Yeah.
A lot of times. But also, in the way that they raise the children, if they have them at home, this might be a terrible thing to say, but I don't know, maybe I am hoping that the time that I spend with their children can give them time to do these things that I believe in.
Maybe. But on the other hand, like, a public school teacher in New York, I have a friend who worked there, and because it's, like, he worked in this really, like, he was the third professor to a high school teacher to have been taken on the job because the previous two were murdered. So he had, like, a super salary because it's, no one would take that job. And he was, like, he got just this guy's salary, and he felt like, he left the job after 2 years because he felt, like, horrible, because his salary could have solved all the abuse, like, of all the class, all the students. Like, if they distributed, like, 10,000 each for family that he was taken, it would have been, like, it would have been easier. I mean, think of the money to adopt a child from Russia or Ukraine or China. Thousands of dollars, like, a whole village would thrive on that. Maybe yours. I'm not talking about you personally. I'm just, like, pointing out to the problems and that you can see. I'm not telling you, like, quit right now. I'm just pointing to the problems. And sometimes, actually, the lower compensation we get, the more it kind of soothes our conscience, exactly, because we feel like we're also oppressed and undoing this, but still it's kind of, you're living with it and off it, you know? It's like, even like Eileen yesterday said, I don't get anything from my books. But the fact that she still can afford to write those books and can afford to have a voice, it still speaks, like, it's still at the expense of maybe 100 Palestinian children that could have, you know, spoken to us, you know? It's still, and so it shuts them off at her expense. Even maybe that her intentions are the best and she's passionate about it. You know, it's like, so that's, you know, these are the problems that you just have to be aware and looking for. Yeah, the kids are abandoned, and I know that if you won't be with them, they most probably will be in a worse situation. And sometimes you can't help that situation. We have a kid who was, like, at 10 years, our neighbor's kid, at 10 years, he was lost to crystal meth. I tried, as a neighbor, the best I can, you know, inviting him to my kid, you know, sharing her pains, you know, trying, like, to dope, like, there's other things. No, it's, like, you can't do it. It's, like, such suffering for generations, such suffering. And no school, and Canada is supposed to have all this, you know, great social policies and great, like, help. Nothing could be done, you know, so...
Including giving the 10,000 to the people. If they're damaged for generations, they're probably going to just use it for dope. I mean, they're not going to say, yeah, well, let's watch Sesame Street or something. They're going to, you know, shoot up.
Yeah.
And, you know, your, what you did with the deconstructing, when you talked about some of the children's literature, some of the, it struck me as just a marvelous alternative. The fellow who brought up deconstruction, trying to sort of make a case for Derrida and deconstruction, and I just thought, there's the deconstruction, there's the liberatory version of it, it seems to me, what you were doing. But, you know, it's also clear, this is not going to be any big new datum for you, but that includes us too, what you were saying about we're dependent on the misery. I wouldn't have anything to write about. I mean, if we're trying to solve the problem of alienation or think of a way to disalienate it, to contribute to that project, but, you know, it's not just the, what do we call them, do-gooders. I mean, it'd be wonderful, if I didn't have anything to write about in terms of immiseration, or get on the radio every week and talk about the latest lunacy.
And give them the good news, there's nothing to talk about.
Yeah, I would just say, well, let's play some music, or I don't know what, you know, but, so, I mean, just, you know, that doesn't invalidate it.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. Oh, that's why there's despair. But just don't take any medication for it.
Maybe I'll do it with you.
No, don't do that either. But that's actually, it's a healthy, like, I find depression and despair, I constantly, by the way, they're a healthy reaction to the, but as long as you don't succumb to that, like, you don't become inactive, like, you still do where you see you can do something, and it could be really little. Even if, like, I'm aware, I'm in academia, it's really oppressive. Okay, I'm not, like, making a living off it. I call it living. But, you know, but still, you know, I do suckle up, you know, to a few teaching classes, you know, this and that. Yeah, you know, I try to open up the minds for the people to, you know, for the future teachers to come. But I'm also aware that I'm still grading them. You know, I still have this power that they don't. You know, and this is something I have, like, I cannot lie to myself and say, oh, but I'm doing it in a good way. You know, I'm doing it. And I have to live with it. But I hope, you know, if enough will hear, I won't have to do it, and nobody will have to do what they're doing, and you could be with the kids because they want to be with you, not because you're both entrapped in this situation, you know?
My question is for both of you. It's about what would ideally reform look like for behaviors such as including if you were assaulted, like, how, from like your perspective, how would that work out?
Wow. Yeah, that's a hard one, because when you see like you read the biographies of the real big criminals, serial killers, rapists, they come from the most impoverished, most abused environment. And or oppressive, in other ways. But you really see, like, I don't have any names. I don't even like to retain those names. But a lot of the people I'm thinking of, really, like, so I don't know, like, how do you heal the disease? Again, like, all we have is the statistics from this domesticated environment. Like, in the wild, from what I've seen, for cats, if a female cat doesn't want it, it's not going to happen. And they follow, like, it's a cycle, She goes out and she calls the cats, and then they come, and then they compete. And then they have a whole party going on for a couple of days, don't let anyone sleep, and then it's all quiet. So animals have worked it out, because it's a mutual, it's something they respond to. I don't like to use the word instinct, because it kind of biologizes it. I think it's a certain knowledge that they have of what the needs are. Wild animals, all wild animals. A knowledge that we have lost, that we have replaced with this knowledge of ownership and possession. So of course, coming in this, talking about this. That in domestication, when you view things like, in Winnie the Pooh. I mean, no one would think that the setting for that story is about pornography, is about the right of someone to exist for pleasing the other. So that's like, that's property relations. And rape occurs in property relations all the time. I don't know, like, maybe a way to look at it is that, and maybe it can help
that, you know, we have to heal on, like, this is just one aspect of what can be raped in us. Our will gets raped every day. Everybody's will gets raped every day. We get raped, you know, by the clothes we're forced to wear. It's like, you know, everything. And we participate in raping others, you know, by using animals for certain needs. Emotional as pets, or, you know, feeding or working, you know, slavery. So, you know, so rape is intrinsic to domesticated relations. I mean, that's like, I mean, the whole idea of sexuality in the fall, like, that's when it starts. That's like the sin. And then Adam and Eve will know each other carnally. I mean, it doesn't mean that they didn't feel and they didn't express their feelings and intercourse in intellectual, emotional, physical, on all levels. But with the fall, even that becomes part of the knowledge. So, you know, maybe, like, you know, if you start deconstructing it, like, really deep, like, we'll see how much, like, it's an incredible that you could, you know, have the strength to share this with us. And maybe it will help you question and bring more insights to this debate. So, appreciate that.
Sorry. No, not on the terms of your somebody else.
Anyone else? Or you ready? No, any more questions to John?
I guess that I would just say it's sort of a summation of the talks we've had. I think it's so important to have these times, you know, just trying to find spaces to do this, because it happens so rarely that there's honest discussion like this, linking deep philosophical concepts and things that are usually, you know, so compartmentalized, the fragmentation of ourselves carries over to our interactions, our conversations. It's so important to have discussions like this to give voice to things that are just continually unsaid, and dealing with the horrible things that are, it's not just these abstract concepts, words like domestication that don't get used very much. Trying to bring these into the common vernacular to, you know, add depth in some way of dealing with the possibility of healing from coming to empathy, you know, empathy, healing, all these things that I think there's a genuine desire. I'm glad that we're able to do this, at least, you know, however it's happened.
I want to thank everyone here and everyone who wasn't there for their contributions.